against a black screen, the WB Warner Brothers shield. The shield on letter B disappears. The middle stroke of the letter W becomes red. Warner Independent Pictures, a Time Warner company. A broken paved road leads to a Roman columned arch. Appian Way. Four interlinking circles. Tree Media Group. Sunshine breaks through swirling cloud over a vast landscape. A human fetus curled up in its mother's womb. A hurricane. A turtle swims over a rocky ocean floor. A land of ice. A rainforest. The hurricane. The fetus. Crowds flee. A crescent moon tumbles through a golden sky. Down a throat towards the respiratory tract and esophagus. A smoking, golden, burning orb. Thick engulfing clouds of smoke. Oil wells burn. Flies crawl over a dying child. A decontamination tent. Car fumes. Famine. A river of mud. A landslide. War, pollution, gazelles, a knife cuts through raw meat, lightning, a baboon bears its fangs, headless plucked chickens on a conveyor belt, crowds by a train, molten lava, a sea of car tires, a polar bear scavenges in a burning dump. Meat on a conveyor belt, the stock exchange, fires blaze through a forest, a combine harvester sweeps through a grain field, roads packed with cars. A tree is felled, the land burns, an iceberg crumbles. The 11th hour. The sun rises, illuminating the curve of the earth, its surface speckled with dots of light. A series of interviews presented by Leonardo DiCaprio.
You know, when you look at the history of humanity, it's basically this relationship between the two most complicated systems on Earth, human society and nature, and whether people have in fact lived in a good balance in that regard. And when they don't, they're gone. And you know, at the end of the day, when we all talk about saving the environment, in a way it's misstated, because the environment is going to survive. We're the ones who may not survive, or we may survive in a world that we don't particularly want to live in.
Our biosphere is sick. We have a planet that's behaving like an infected organism. If you look at it from outer space, you see all these lights, and it's the lights of planet Earth, it's the lights of the people, but it's also almost like looking at an organism that has an infection on it, that is forming a crust of some kind.
Well, I don't only think that the biosphere is in trouble. I know it is. I just have to look around in the environment in which I live.
What I hear in my dreams is generations in the future screaming back to us in time, saying, "What are you doing? Don't you see? We are at this critical point in time, and we have evolved to be the leaders of our biological community, and we are misleading. We are causing the devastation to our very foundation of our life system that has given us birth, and we are ultimately committing suicide."
So as we destroy nature, we will be destroyed in the process. There's no escaping that conclusion.
Earth's life support systems damaged. The human species at risk. Could this be true? In this film, we've reached out to independent experts on the front lines of what could be the greatest challenge of our time, the collapse of our planet's ecosystems, and our search for solutions to create a sustainable future. So, if we look for the cause of this planetary destruction, what would we find?
We would find a global civilization created by the human mind, a mind that has evolved to have the ability to reflect back on ourselves, to take stock of our own existence, a mind able to discover quantum physics, explore outer space, and peer into our own DNA. But beyond our stunning intellectual and technological advances, we would also see our large-scale impact on our home, planet Earth. Now, ecological disasters are rarely covered, and when they are, they're depicted as isolated incidents by the media. But if we connect these events, will we find a larger story that needs to be told? A human story. And more so than that, a global understanding that takes into account who we are and the state of our relationship to this planet, our only home.
The luminous curve of planet Earth in black space, its blue surface mottled with white cloud. Professor Stephen Hawking.
Life on Earth is possible only because a number of parameters lie in certain very narrow ranges. Some of these are clearly environmental, like the Earth has the right temperature and pressure to have liquid water.
Creation is the universe. Creation is everything that we can see, and probably a whole lot that we can't, probably more that we can't see. But it's what's about us, and it's the relationship, this amazing web of life that we have here.
Well, Earth is a planet that's just far enough from the sun and has just enough of an atmosphere of a certain composition that more heat stays here than radiates out to space. And the sun warms the planet, and that heat radiates out, and there's gases in the atmosphere that have always trapped some of that heat. And that's why we're not an ice ball. And there's been scientists who compared this whole business of the different planets going away from the sun as being like the Goldilocks effect. There's one that's too cold, one that's too warm, and one that's just right, and we just happen to be there.
40 million centuries ago, that a cell formed, and that cell had a gene, and that gene is the password to every single other form of life there is. And the amazing thing about the human body is it has 100 trillion cells, and 90% of them are not human cells. They're fungi and bacteria, microorganisms, and the thing that makes us human is not human. So within us is basically the backstory of life on Earth right to that first original cell 40 million centuries ago. And if you could, for a moment, stop and feel what is happening in your body, there are 6 septillion things going on at the same time. That's a 6 with 24 zeros after it, okay? Going on right now, right this instant, as you sit in your chair, and then in the next instant, within 10 seconds, 100 more things have happened than in all the stars and planets and asteroids in the known universe in your body. And that is called life.
Bathed in blue light, a cell divides in two. Janine Benyus, author of Biomimicry.
Homo sapiens sapiens is an incredibly young species. We don't think of that, but we are. We came very late in the calendar year of the Earth. You know, if the Earth calendar, you know, where it started in January 1 and now we're December 31st. We got here 15 minutes before midnight. On December 31st, and all of recorded history has blinked by in the last 60 seconds.
Perhaps the best description of what we are is, as Jared Diamond puts it, the third chimpanzee. The two kinds of chimpanzees, and they're us. But in some ways, we are extraordinarily special. And the most obvious one is our extraordinary ability to make tools, our extraordinary ability to communicate, to have very detailed discussions with each other.
So we are fundamentally groups of animals randomly scattered throughout the planet, slowly coalescing in groups that are more powerful, larger, and very much conditioned by two essential characters. One is opportunism, and the other one is greed. All the animals and vegetables are opportunistic creatures. They do what's necessary for them to do in order to survive.
I think it was a human mind, basically, that threw us out of balance with the rest of nature. The tragedy is that it was the human mind that was the key to our very survival. Now, when you think that we evolved in Africa about 150,000 years ago, and compared to the other animals that must have been on the plains at that time, we weren't very impressive. We weren't very many. We weren't very big. We weren't gifted with special senses. The one thing, the key to our survival and our taking over the planet was a human brain. But because a human mind invented the concept of a future, we're the only animal on the planet that actually was able to recognize we could affect the future by what we do today. We look ahead, recognize where the opportunities are, where the dangers lay, and choose accordingly to survive. That was a great survival strategy of our species.
A grey pollution cloud hangs over a city. Muted lights shine from windows in a high rise.
If the human mind threw us out of balance thousands of years ago, what changed in recent history? In the last century, we have dramatically increased our impact on planet Earth. One element has emerged that has made us even more destructive, accelerating our disconnection and causing extensive damage to our climate and all other natural systems.
There's a fundamental illusion in the world that somehow people are separate from nature, when the reality is that we are part of nature. In fact, we are nature. And that's probably the most fundamental misunderstanding in the world that's causing all this havoc.
I think one of the reasons why it's so difficult for people to get it that we're connected with nature and to even understand the fundamentals of eco-literacy is because in many ways it flies in the face of the assumptions of our culture. Our culture is built on the assumption that we are the superior life form on Earth, that we are separate from all other life forms, that we have been given dominion over all of the life forms.
But even to think that we're separated from nature is somehow a thinking disorder. You can't be separated from nature. Why we think that way is the interesting thing. What happens in the mind that likes to think that it's separated from nature? Does that mean that the mind or the human being thinks he's now more free?
We're totally living in disharmony with the planet. And not just the planet, with beyond the planet. I mean, we're far beyond the planet now. We're zooming around Mars and all of that exploration, which is marvelous. But it's not really affecting our attitudes. I think our attitudes are based on selfishness, based on the economic situation we have, based on the politics which we have. I mean, how many governments in the world have really taken the environmental crisis for what it is? Very few, certainly not the United States.
We live in a human-created environment where it's very easy to think we're different from other creatures. We're smart. We create our own habitat. We don't need nature. It's the economy that's the most important thing. And in focusing on the economy, I think we've forgotten these ancient truths, these ancient wisdoms that kept us plugged in to nature, and understanding that, gee, if we do something to offend the natural world, we're going to pay a price for that. We have to treat nature much more gently. That's the lesson, I think, that we've forgotten and that we're paying a price for today.
The big rupture came in the 1800s and the 19th century with the steam engine, the fossil fuel age, the Industrial Revolution. This was a great rupture from earlier forms and rhythms of life, which were generally regenerative. What happened after the Industrial Revolution was that nature was converted to a resource, and that resource was seen as essentially eternally abundant. This led to the idea and the conception behind progress, which is limitless growth, limitless expansion.
A road has surfaced.
For all of human history, for the vast majority of human history, humans lived on current sunlight. Sun fell on the fields grew plants, the plants made cellulose, plant matter, animals ate the cellulose. We ate the plants, we ate the animals, we wore clothing made out of the plants and animals. We were living off of current sunlight. It was our food supply, it was our clothing, we heated with wood, it was our heat supply, it was our light supply, it was all current sunlight. So the sunlight that fell on the earth in a year was the maximum amount of sunlight that we could use. It was the maximum amount of energy that we could use. And from the earliest evidence of human civilization, 150,000 more or less years ago, up until a few thousand years ago, pretty much that's how we lived. And our population never surpassed 1 billion people. And then we began discovering that there were these little pockets of ancient sunlight, and finding coal here and a little bit of oil there. And slowly, between that and the agricultural revolution, slowly our population crept up until we hit our first 1 billion people. And so it didn't take us 100,000 years to go from 1 billion to 2 billion. Our second billion only took us 130 years. We hit 2 billion people in 1930. Our third billion took only 30 years, 1960. It's amazing when you think about it. When John Kennedy was inaugurated, there were half as many people on the planet as there are today. And the reason that we've been able to have this exponential growth of population is because we're creating food and clothing and everything else, transportation, we're doing it all with this ancient sunlight that was stored in the Earth 300 and 400 million years ago. And if we were to have to go back to simply living off current sunlight, lacking technology, the planet couldn't sustain more than 500 million to, at the most, 1 billion people.
So we live in the most unusual period in the history of the planet in terms of a species getting access to energy-rich carbon. What we have done is become good alchemists. The ability to take fossil carbon and turn it into human biomass, and we have used the supermarket, the transportation system, to make that happen. So the cornerstones of this system that we have are all resting upon non-renewable, energy-rich carbon we call fossil fuels.
The real problem is that there are too many of us using too many resources too fast. Now, oil has enabled us to do that. We use oil to increase the rate at which we extract all other resources, everything from topsoil to fresh water to from aluminum to zinc.
Oil is really the basis with which we sustain complexity and with which we solve our problems. In a sense, all of our lives are subsidized. We are subsidized by oil. Because we're subsidized by oil, when we shop for anything at a store, we don't pay the full price. We don't pay the full cost of what it took to produce that.
We borrow about $800 billion a year from the world to finance the excess of our consumption over what we produce. And about a third of that, about $250 billion a year, is for oil imports. So we borrow from the world. We issue IOUs, treasury bills, whatever, to the tune of about $1 billion a day, every working day anyway, to finance our oil imports.
There's a lot of harm that oil does. The economists would call them externalities because they're external to the price that you pay at the pump. For example, the asthma rates among children, which are growing in many parts of the U.S., the acid rain problem that's caused by burning coal. If you look at some of the global warming contributions from burning fossil fuels, and at least part of the cost of keeping our troops in the Middle East to safeguard oil assets. Maybe not all of that cost, but at least some of it is clearly a subsidy that goes to oil.
And when you started feeding off of the fossil fuel cycle, we became living with a death-based cycle. And that death cycle of dependency on extraction of those resources set in motion a sequence of events that has led us to our modern crisis of global disturbance known as climate change or global warming, if you will.
We don't know the future, we know the past. We know the past in part through Greek mythology, the kind of the revenge of the gods or the revenge of nature. I think we're seeing that now already after 200 years of the Industrial Revolution. We didn't know what we were creating. We didn't know the damage that was being created. We're sensing that. So as we go forward with technologies even more powerful than before, we have magnified the presence of the human race inside the ecology. Therefore, we can do vastly more damage with our technological prowess than we could before. We have to be even more cautious.
Tall grasses bend with a breeze, framed by a golden sunset. The silhouettes of acacia trees on a savanna at dusk. A white mist drifts over a green canopy of treetops on a mountain range. A loch, still and beautiful. The jagged pinnacle of a snow-covered mountain. Icebergs like floating towers of white fondant. Black crags of rock speckled with snow. A jet stream in a blue sky.
While we weren't looking, we've created one of the biggest problems facing all of humanity, climate change. What does it look like when we don't pay attention to the massive amounts of CO2 we dump into the air and water? What does it look like when our actions shift the natural chemical balance of our atmosphere into a state several degrees warmer, a state that hasn't existed for millennia? We have witnessed in recent years the highest average temperatures in recorded history. Now, a couple degrees difference in today's temperatures may not sound like much, but it only took a few degrees to shift us out of the last ice age. And a few degrees may be all that separates us from catastrophic change.
Heading into another weekend, the weather and the climate are making news in more than one region. A terrible drought has already
taken hold. We do not know how much our climate could or will change in the future.
More than a week of severe flooding has killed at least 72 people in central and eastern Europe and western Russia.
The heaviest recorded rainfall in Indian history has unleashed the worst flooding in living memory.
We do not know how fast change will occur. or even how some of our actions could impact.
In Chicago, the heat is a plague. This morning, they were collecting
thousands
bodies.
Thousands of firefighters
again.
In Southern California are battling a newly formed super wildfire.
The heat is on coast to coast. Even Arizona is having a heat.
Tennessee was battered by killer tornadoes.
New Orleans is no longer safe to live in. It is that simple. And that's stark.
Hell and high water, one and the same again today in a city overwhelmed, under siege, in the grip of unmitigated, unprecedented catastrophe.
Nowhere is that more apparent, of course, than New Orleans, now a city of displaced people, refugees.
20 feet of water from Lake Pontchartrain. Add to that violence, deprivation, desperation, the rising threat of disease.
Should it be that man-made global warming is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people?
Republican Senator James Inhofe. The swirling eye of a hurricane. New Orleans, August 2005. News footage of the hurricane raging through the city. In its wake, a city half submerged in floodwater. New Orleans present. A curtain billows in a derelict house.
One of the most serious consequences of our actions is global warming, brought about by rising levels of carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. The danger is that the temperature increase might become self-sustaining, if it has not done so already. Drought and deforestation are reducing the amount of carbon dioxide recycled into the atmosphere, and the warming of the seas may trigger the release of large quantities of CO2 trapped on the ocean floor. In addition, the melting of the Arctic and Antarctic ice sheets will reduce the amount of solar energy reflected back into space, and so increase the temperature further. We don't know where the global warming would stop, but the worst case scenario is that Earth would become like its sister planet, Venus, with a temperature of 250 centigrade, and raining sulfuric acid. The human race could not survive in those conditions.
Stephen Schneider, co-director, Center for Environmental Science and Policy, Stanford University.
Well, the Earth has a natural greenhouse effect. In fact, we're about 60 degrees Fahrenheit warmer thanks to those good guys, water vapor and carbon dioxide and methane, what we call greenhouse gases, trapping heat. That's the good part of the story. The problem is that humans are competing with nature in that when we use our tailpipes and our smokestacks to put our waste into the atmosphere as if it's some kind of unpriced sewer, we're adding to that amount of greenhouse gases that's natural, unnatural stuff, mostly carbon dioxide, methane, chemicals that nobody's ever seen before, chlorofluorocarbons, which also affect ozone. And when they build up, they trap extra heat. And that's not controversial. That's well understood. We know we've increased carbon dioxide by about 30-35%, methane 150%, added gases that never existed before. And the Earth is warmer. All of that goes together and makes global warming not only a reality, but a concern for the future, because we're continuing doing what we're doing at an accelerating rate.
The record shows that greenhouse gases, or carbon dioxide in particular, did not go above 280 parts per million over the last 650,000 years. We're now over 400 parts per million, coming close to what many scientists are now referring to as a tipping point where we lose control of climate. And once we've lost control of climate, then things like Katrina, Katrina-scale events will become simply the norm.
Unless we're able to quickly reduce, very quickly and very dramatically reduce our use of fossil fuel, the computer modeling's pretty clear. Having increased the temperature 1 degree so far, we'll increase it about another 5 degrees. That'll make the Earth warmer than it's been for tens of millions of years.
Some scientists are amazed that in the media debate and in front of Congress, we hear about people who I believe in or I don't believe in global warming, as if this were somehow some object of religion as opposed to based in evidence. And scientists look at evidence.
The scientists have a tremendous amount of agreement over some of the basic principles of global warming. Is the Earth warming? Absolutely. Is some portion of the warming due to human activity? Absolutely. These are things that there's a consensus in the international scientific community.
There's no doubt about that. The natural changes, the speed of the natural changes is now dwarfed by the changes that humans are making to the atmosphere and to the surface.
Jim Hansen, who's the director of the NASA Institute for Space Studies, recently gave a best estimate, and that was based on research done last year. And the current estimate is that the Earth has warmed up by about 0.7 degrees centigrade. And even if we were to cap CO2 carbon dioxide emissions to the level that they are now, the Earth should still warm by an additional about a half a degree centigrade.
That's been enough to melt 20% of the sea ice in the Arctic. It's been enough to speed up the spin and duration of hurricanes about 50%. It's been enough to start the permafrost beneath the tundra across the north melting.
Even at the low range, a couple of degrees in the average can really change things profoundly in some parts of the world, where you have more of an amplifying effect, like in the Arctic.
A large crack in a sheet of ice.
You can feel this, the chunk that we're on, actually starting to fail a bit more. Probably hairline cracks up towards the helos there.
Shilawat Cloutier, Inuit Circumpolar Conference.
The human impacts, and particularly of what's happening with global warming, climate changes in the Arctic, it is happening first and fastest in the Arctic. We're starting to see that things are happening even faster than what scientists have indicated. By the end of the century, perhaps even in a few decades, the Arctic will be quite ice-free.
Well, climate change is going to have a very strong and fundamental impact on the global water cycle. It's going to change rainfall patterns. It's going to very likely increase our experience with floods and droughts. It's almost certainly going to change the pattern of river flows throughout the year. And these are all very, very fundamental aspects of how we manage and use water.
What global warming does, or what the climate change is linked to global warming, what those changes do is they add another dimension of uncertainty. It threatens your food security, for example. It threatens your water security. It threatens your sea level security. It threatens your security against storms and hurricanes and all these things that are in the news that we've seen.
It's a national security problem in the sense that Florida might be the first affected, as well as other coastal parts of the United States. But more importantly than that, it's an international security problem.
A table illustrates a global comparison of the effects of sea level increases.
The UN estimates that by the middle of the century, there may be 150 million environmental refugees at any given time from climate change.
What we saw with Katrina, to me, is just prologue. I just think that worse is yet to come on that front. Global warming is real, and it's destructive, and its impacts defy the imagination. So we've got bad things happening on a lot of fronts, and Earth is hurting, and humans have not figured out how to change their ways, and we're the culprit.
That was Ray Anderson, founder of Interface Inc. Waves crash onto rocks. Rays of sunshine break through a canopy of trees. Grey cloud drifts, and sunlight illuminates a green hilltop.
Global warming has taken much of our attention, as it should. But as carbon has been accumulating in the atmosphere, it has also been accumulating in the ocean. And as time has passed, deforestation, soil erosion, vanishing wetlands, and a whole host of other problems have continued unabated. We face a convergence of crises, all of which are a concern for life.
A bird soars through a blue sky. Paul Hawken, author, environmentalist, entrepreneur.
The problem that confronts us is that every living system in the biosphere is in decline, and the rate of decline is accelerating. There isn't one peer-reviewed scientific article in the past 20 years that's been published that contradicts that statement. Living systems are coral reefs, there are climatic stability, forest cover, the oceans themselves, aquifers, water, the conditions of the soil, biodiversity. They go on and on as they get more specific. But the fact is, there isn't one living system that is stable or is improving. And those living systems provide the basis for all life.
David Suzuki, scientist.
I sat on a United Nations group called the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, a four-year study, the biggest study ever done of ecosystems around the world. It involved over 1,300 scientists from 71 countries in the world. At the end of that, in March of 2005, the final reports came in, and they documented the staggering destruction of ecosystems and the services they perform for us around the world.
We better, first of all, acknowledge that the planet is seamless. For instance, the fertilizer and the pesticides that are applied in the fields of the upper Midwest go down the Mississippi, and 1,100 miles away, there's a dead zone.
the reality with air pollution is there's no away. The impacts can range from headaches, drowsiness, lethargy, to much more serious impacts, not only aggravating asthma, but actually causing asthma.
I mean, people didn't talk about asthma a few decades ago. Now I can walk into a classroom in a public elementary school and ask the kids, how many of you have asthma? And you'll see 30% of the kids in the room will have their hands raised, at least 30%. You know, in some classrooms, it'll be 60%.
There's an ocean crisis that is occurring right now. And the upshot is that we've taken too much out of the ocean. We've put too much into the ocean, too much pollution, and we're wrecking the edge of the ocean.
We've lost 90% of most of the big fish in the sea in half a century. So we're turning to deeper areas, further areas offshore.
So between overfishing and bycatch, we're really removing millions, if not billions of animals from the ocean every year. Many of them don't even become food for humans. They just are wasted.
What we put into the ocean, millions of tons of things that aren't natural to the sea, that come back to us in perverse ways. Some fish concentrate these substances, things like mercury, heavy metals of various sorts, the pesticides, the herbicides.
Corporations, they dump on the equivalent, you know, at the smallest, they do 5 million gallons per day of toxins into the bay. It's everything from benzene to acrylonitrile to mercury to copper to you name it. They've got it.
A lot of the chemicals that have become very common in our world today, things in plastics, artificial colors, pesticides, are really high on the list of suspect agents that promote cancer, that promote premature aging, that increase risks of chronic degenerative diseases.
Why don't we think about some of these disorders, such as autism, ADHD, childhood cancers, childhood diabetes, childhood behavioral problems, Parkinson's disorders. This has now even been linked with Alzheimer's disorders. And then, of course, we've got the early onsets of testicular cancers in males, the epidemic of prostate cancer and breast cancers. The list just keeps growing, and exposure to chemicals while in the womb prior to birth could be contributing to these disturbing findings.
The communities that are most impacted by pollution, and in fact have the most toxic sources of pollution, are often low-income communities of color.
They're the dumping grounds for power plants, they're the dumping grounds for bus depots, for oil refineries, for any number of waste facilities and everything that no one else wants, whether it's the South Bronx, whether it's Louisiana in Cancer Alley.
Our food is becoming poisoned to the point that we should worry about it. There's less and less of it. The water, it's becoming more and more unhealthy to just swim in the ocean. And all of these are simple to understand canaries in the coal mine of much more subtle and scary disasters on the horizon.
70 countries in the world no longer have any intact or original forests. And here in the United States, 95% of our old-growth forests are already gone.
Gloria Flora, Sustainable Obtainable Solutions.
In many cases, the forest will not grow back, and that land is then converted to grassland. But in the case of rainforests, we have seen firsthand that when those trees are removed, no, they do not come back. The land becomes extremely dry, and the nutrient cycling that those trees used to do is no longer functioning. What that leads to next? Deserts. We've seen them, and we've watched them grow around the world. As we have removed trees from along the edges of very dry areas, that desertification has spread where there used to be forests.
In my own part of the world, I keep telling people, let us not cut trees irresponsibly. Let us not destroy, especially the forested mountains. Because if you destroy the forests on these mountains, the rivers will stop flowing, and the rains will become irregular, and the crops will fail, and you will die of hunger and starvation. Now, the problem is people don't make those linkages.
Well, over 30% of the soils of the planet have been put into the category of, I think, serious degradation. And the practices of agriculture is eroding that ecological capital that is as much, for all practical purposes, a non-renewable resource as oil.
One of the things we don't see or think about when we look at a tree is, what's the volume? How much water could be contained there? It turns out to be 57,000 gallons of water in a 10 to 12 inch flash flood. It can grab that much water, prevent it from running off, captures it in that sponge, cleans it, puts it back in the aquifer. Take that one tree away, and you've got a flood. You've got soil erosion. You've lost those 57,000 gallons from the local water supply. And then that water is rushing on downstream, hurting people, hurting communities, ultimately polluting the ocean.
We really could tip the ocean into a different state. The health of the ocean as we know it depends on the water turning over, of the surface water sinking to the bottom and the bottom water coming up to the top. It's conceivable that we could turn that conveyor belt off by warming of the surface of the ocean a little bit too much. And if we do that, we, with all of our dead zones, we could make the surface, the whole damn surface ocean, stagnant. And that's a terrifying thought. The last time that happened was the end Permian mass extinction, and more than 95% of all the species on the Earth went extinct.
Tall green pine trees cover a mountainside. In the distance, a snow-capped mountain range. Streams of water gush down a vertical cliff wall into a sweeping valley. A mountainous landscape includes a volcano with a lava-filled crater. A white mist hangs over the brown, weathered rock surface. Mounds of moss-covered rock like tiny islands along a coastline. White waves wash onto a shoreline. Rocks like jagged teeth protrude from the sea, an expanse of flat sandy beach. A shoal of fish swirl in a circular swarm just beneath the surface of the ocean. Two seals tumble through the water. A stingray glides over coral and floating green fronds through swaying strings of seaweed. Sun breaks over a calm ocean.
The simple fact is, ecosystems that sustain life are unraveling. Systems that have evolved for hundreds of millions of years. The evidence is now clear. Industrial civilization has caused irreparable damage, and our impact is only accelerating. We have lost the last 30 years in the war against global warming. The questions then arise, why aren't we responding? But more important, what are the forces that are blocking change?
An empty boardroom.
Probably the greatest weapon of mass destruction is corporate economic globalization. And there's always been a greed factor in human civilization, and what has happened with the creation of corporations, which are the dominant institution of our age, is that they have perfected that as a system. And what we literally face today is that this is going to kill off our host, the planet.
Today, ecosystems, forests, streams, lakes, rivers, they have no rights. They're property, which means they can be bought, sold, destroyed, traded, carved up. Under this structure of law, you're either property or you're a person. And it's very clear that nature is property. And so the reason why we have these reams of documents in the libraries about solutions, about solar, about how to produce food in a sustainable way, about transportation, about changing production methods and putting in place a sustainable economy that respects the planet, is that we've lacked the authority to drive those things into law, because in reality we have a constitution that empowers the corporate few to make decisions that trump the majority, and has been our failure to drive real law into place because we don't have the authority.
The reality is we have very responsive political leaders. They're just responsive to wealth and to money and to corporate power. ExxonMobil, one oil company, is worth more than the sum of the value of all the auto companies in the whole wide world. That is a big company. People say, gee, why aren't politicians responding to the global climate crisis? Why aren't they? Because they're responsive to a higher power, unfortunately. And right now that higher power is the fossil fuel industry.
You're responsible for editing Our Changing Planet, and you send a review draft to the White House. What happens?
It comes back with a large number of edits, handwritten on the hard copy by the chief of staff of the Council on Environmental Quality.
And the chief of staff is whom?
Phil Cooney.
He is a scientist?
No, he's a lawyer. He was a lobbyist for the American Petroleum Institute before going into the White House.
Our people have a growing suspicion that the oil companies are taking unfair advantage of the current market conditions to line their coffers with excess profits.
David Orr, Oberlin College.
On the issues of climate change and environment, the political system has failed us. It's not first and foremost a crisis of technology. It isn't even a crisis of public opinion. If you ask the public, do you want solar energy? Do you want efficient appliances? Do you want efficient cars? The answers come back overwhelmingly, yes, we do. It's the bridge across this chasm of public opinion to public policy. It's called government. That's where the failure has been. That bridge has fallen into disrepair. There was a time in the 1960s and 1970s when Republicans and Democrats in the United States joined to pass the major environmental laws of the time, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act. Those were done by Republicans and Democrats coming together. And that system is now broken. And part of the crisis is, as everybody knows, it's that there is money, too much money, in the political system.
We need to understand that even folks like Jefferson said, we have to remake and rewrite the Constitution every generation to meet our need. Do we think that the Founding Fathers understood anything about global warming or deforestation or the massive amounts of toxic chemicals that are pumped into our atmosphere and into our air and water, land, and soil every day? What we need to do is find a harmony between people and nature. And one of the only ways to do that is to drive and recognize that nature has rights too.
An explosion in a quarry. Herman Daly, former senior economist, World Bank.
I think the most basic thing to understand about our global economic system is that it's a subsystem. And it's a subsystem of a larger system. The larger system is the biosphere, and the subsystem is the economy. The problem, of course, is that our subsystem, the economy, is geared for growth. It's all set up to grow, to expand, whereas the parent system doesn't grow. It remains the same size. So as the economy grows, it displaces, it encroaches upon the biosphere, and this is a fundamental cost. This is the fundamental opportunity cost of economic growth. That's what you give up when you expand. You give up what used to be there.
So economists don't include all of the things that nature does for us for nothing. Some technologies would never be able to do what nature does. For example, pollinating all of the flowering plants. What would it cost us to take carbon dioxide out of the air and put oxygen back in it, which all the green things do for us for nothing? It's possible to do a crude estimate of what it would cost us to replace nature. Well, it turns out Constanza, this is several years ago, estimated it would cost us $35 trillion a year to do what nature is doing for us for nothing. Now, to put that in perspective, if you added up all of the annual economies of all the countries in the world at that time, it came to $18 trillion. So nature was doing twice as much service for us as the economies of the world. And in the madness of conventional economics, this isn't in the equation.
Somehow, in the last few decades in business school and the MBAs that these CEOs have, they were trained that the object of their business is growth, as if that were an end. It's not an end, it's a means. And we flip the ends and the means, and if we can get the end back, quality of life, then we have to look at the contradictions, because the wrong kind of growth reduces our quality of life, and we have to retake that back.
I think the industrial system has to be reinvented. Today, the throughput of the industrial system from mine and wellhead through to finished product that ends up in a landfill or an incinerator. For every truckload of product with lasting value, 32 truckloads of waste are produced. And that, you know, is mind-boggling, but it's true. So we have a system that is a waste-making system. Clearly, we cannot continue to dig up the earth and turn it to waste.
Electricity pylons, factories, and funnels.
In our modern globalized world, growth continues to be the focus of many corporations and governments who deplete our environment for economic gain. But what about us, as individuals, as consumers? To what extent are we participants in the destruction of our biosphere?
Tom Hartman, author of The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight.
The problem is not a problem of technology. The problem is not a problem of too much carbon dioxide. The problem is not a problem of global warming. The problem is not a problem of waste. All of those things are symptoms of the problem. The problem is the way that we are thinking. The problem is fundamentally a cultural problem. It's at the level of our culture that this illness is happening.
We're now products of $500 billion of advertising each year. By the time a child comes to college or grows up through school and is a first-year student in college, they'll have seen thousands of hours of television, on average 4 hours and some minutes per day. And as a result, as one study showed, they could identify 1,000 corporate logos, but fewer than 10 plants and animals native to their own place. And so we become not only consumers, but hugely ignorant of the terms by which we live on the earth.
Well, Americans are spending their time working and spending. That's where most of our time is going. The average American goes shopping in one way or another 5 times a week. During the day, we spend most of our time working to make the money so that we can shop. And there's a growing weariness of having to hold up the global economy, having to sort of keep up with the Joneses. So while everything's getting bigger, our bathtubs, our houses, our vehicles, our waistlines, we're running out of time. We have less of the things we really care about.
In America, people are so insulated by our astonishing concentration of wealth. I mean, Americans spend more money maintaining our lawns than India collects in federal tax revenue. Our defense budget, which is a trivial percentage of GDP, is larger than the entire economy of Australia. So kind of anesthetized by our own wealth, we forget how the majority of the world lives, and indeed how the majority of the world looks.
So where we are now as a civilization is, I would call consumerism is the leading ideology, even consumer democracy. Consumer democracy in the sense that any regime, whether it's the Chinese regime, the US regime, has to give people what they want and when they want it, which is now, and people want consumer goods. Once commodities become cultural symbols, whether it's a cell phone in rural China or a Lamborghini in Malibu, there's no stopping that. You have to change the object of desire in order to get to the root of the problem. People believe in choice, and choice means consumerism for most people. There is no mileage in trying to save the planet by telling people they're making the wrong choice. It's not going to work.
A scrum of people rush into a store as its doors open. Inside, shoppers grab trolleys and race for purchases. A full car park and queues around a block.
You have to change the idea behind limitless expansion. In a phrase, from well-having to well-being, is a cultural transformation.
We've always, as humans, had material desires. Material things are part of how we do define who we are. So it's not that consumption is bad. It's that it's gotten totally out of balance.
Neon-lit Times Square.
Media really is the instrument by which knowledge is passed in our society. We no longer get knowledge directly from the earth. We're no longer in touch with the sources of our survival. We no longer, for the most part, in Western industrial society, we're no longer growing our food or taking care of our own sustenance or learning directly from our own experience or having our family be the root of our choices. Basically, we're like the astronaut in space, you know? We're floating around in a metallic, recreated universe, disconnected really from sources on the earth, and we're dependent completely upon the information that is sent to us from very, very far away.
We're psychically numbed. I mean, we numb our senses from morning till night, whether it's with noise or loud music or light at night. So nobody sees the beauty. And if we've lost the feeling of the beauty of the world, then we are looking for substitutes. Eric Hoffer said, you can never get enough of what you don't really want. Meaning we rush around permanently needy But the loss, the feeling of loss, is that we don't know what it is we've lost. What we've lost is the beauty of the world. And we make up for it with attempting to conquer the world or own the world, possess the world.
A snow-capped pinnacle rises out of a mountain range into an ice-blue sky. A satellite image of Central Park, then New York City, then the continent of North America.
One can see from space how the human race has changed the Earth. Nearly all the available land has been cleared of forest and is now used for agriculture or urban development. The polar ice caps are shrinking and the desert areas are increasing. At night, the Earth is no longer dark, but large areas are lit up. All this is evidence that human exploitation of the planet is reaching a critical limit, but human demands and expectations are ever increasing. We cannot continue to pollute the atmosphere, poison the ocean, and exhaust the land. There isn't any more available.
A lone tree stands in a golden meadow. Two people walk along a path beside it, silhouetted against a pink-hued sky.
We are living in an enormously challenging time. If we don't change what we're doing, we are facing losing perhaps a third, maybe a half of all the variety of life on Earth.
What we don't know is at what point that we, when we lose biodiversity, that the system will start to fall apart. Now, I believe in the resilience of nature, so I think that once the human species becomes extinct, and many species have become extinct before us, many species will become extinct after us, that the Earth may well spin on its axis happily without humans, and the microbes and the insects will inherit the world. Unless we cause such a dramatic climate shift that we become an arid, cold planet like Mars.
I don't believe for a minute that life will be extinguished. Even though we've radically altered the air, the water, and the soil of the Earth, life has been incredibly tenacious and adaptable. But as species at the very top of the food chain, I know that we're the most vulnerable. Life has existed on Earth for 3.8 to 4 billion years. Over that time, there have been a lot of species. But you know what? 99.9999, 4 decimal points percent of all species that have ever existed are extinct. So extinction is a natural part of life. Extinction is what has enabled life to flourish and evolve and change with the conditions of the changing planet. The planet hasn't been stuck in one condition over 4 billion years. The tragedy of our existence is that we're an infant species. Not only are we hastening the conditions for our own demise, we're taking down, according to the United Nations Environment Program, 50 to 55,000 species a year are going extinct because of us. The tragedy is not the imminent or potential extinction of humankind, but the enormous extinction crisis that we're causing right now.
Joseph Tainter, author of The Collapse of Complex Societies.
And I think there is potential for a dark age. One of the problems that I see is that so many people who have to individually accept the cost of the transition are unaware that it's coming. Most of our citizens wake up in the morning and worry about the morning commute and getting the kids to school and paying the mortgage and thinking about a new car or a vacation or whatever. And this is simply too narrow a scale of thinking to address the problems that we have. We need people to be aware of the global forces that affect their lives and that will increasingly affect their lives in the future. If this awareness doesn't develop, then I'm afraid the transition will probably be wrenching.
What we risk is the destruction of civilization, everything we fought for, this fragile little craft that's navigated the centuries and the millennia to come to this particular point. It will have been undone in a flash of consumption and bad judgment and violence and injustice.
Is the carrying capacity for a human population that's happy and healthy in a future going away? Absolutely. And it's not about saving the planet. It's about saving a carrying capacity, a system upon which humans can live in the pursuit of happiness. That's what's at stake.
So if you step back and you take an Earth perspective rather than the human perspective, it can't be an 11th hour for the Earth. It can be an extinction crisis for the Earth. And it can be a harmony crisis for the Earth, because we now see that one species is taking over so much of the resources of the Earth that it's leaving very little for other creatures to live with it.
That was Peter Warshall, ecologist, Whole Earth Catalogue. The skeleton and emaciated remains of a large creature lies on a shoreline. Mikhail Gorbachev, founding president, Green Cross International, 1990 Nobel Peace Prize laureate. Well, what happens to our planet is something that should make us think and act differently. We're not acting differently, because we still are, I think, victim to a kind of inertia, going back to the time when someone said, and I believe it was a mistake even when it was said, that man is the king of nature. I think that now that all ecosystems are strained, now that our climate, our water, our soil, our forests are in such a dire state, I believe that this is undermining our very environment. And we must, the generations living now, must take a principled decision that we will act differently, because the ecological crisis is global. DiCaprio's on a hilltop, below him a valley with houses, and beyond that a low mountain range, then another urbanized valley.
So, we find ourselves on the brink. It is clear humans have had a devastating impact on our planet's ecological web of life. Because we have waited, because we have turned our backs on nature's warning signs, and because our political and corporate leaders have consistently ignored the overwhelming scientific evidence, the challenges we face are that much more difficult. We are in the environmental age, whether we like it or not. So what does the future look like? We know the United States, the world's greatest consumer and source of waste, needs to make a transition to a greener future. But will our pivotal generation create a sustainable world in time? What will guide this massive change? And does nature hold the answers we need to help restore our planet's resources, protect our atmosphere, and therefore help all life survive?
Wade Davis, anthropologist.
All of these forces sweeping over the planet are the forces created by human beings. And if human beings are the source of the problem, we can be the foundation of the solution.
Some people suggest that in order to live sustainably, we have to go out in the woods and put on animal skins and live on roots and berries. And the simple reality is that we do have technology. The question is, how can we use our understanding of science and our understanding of technology, along with our understanding of culture and how culture changes, to create a culture that will interact with science and with the world around us in a sustainable fashion?
The great thing about the dilemma we're in is that we get to reimagine every single thing we do. In other words, there isn't one single thing that we make or systems that we have that doesn't require a complete remake. And so there's two ways of looking at that. One is like, oh my gosh, you know, what a big burden. The other way to look at it, which is the way I prefer, is what a great time to be born, what a great time to be alive, because this generation gets to essentially completely change this world.
A group of people stand on a hill at dusk holding flags. William McDonough, architect.
We're at a point in our history with 6.4 billion of us that we have to imagine what it would be like to redesign design itself and see design as the first signal of human intention and realize that we need new intentions for our future where materials are seen as things that are highly valuable and need to go in closed cycles, what we call cradle to cradle instead of cradle to grave. And that energy needs to come from renewable sources, principally the sun, and that water needs to be clean and healthy as it comes in and out of a system, and that we have to treat each other with justice and fairness. So the design itself changes from mass production of things that are essentially destructive to mass utilization of things that are inherently assets instead of liabilities.
Bruce Mau, Bruce Mau Designs.
Our project today for a new generation of designers is the welfare of all of life as a practical objective. It goes beyond ourselves to include the entire ecological realm. That all of life is actually a design project today, that we have to design the capacity to sustain it in the long run.
Whether we're talking about the design of a factory or a building or a road or even a town, it's much easier to design in isolation and superimpose a design on what exists. But if we were to follow nature's operating instructions, it designs in exactly the opposite way. It brings onto the palette, so to speak, all of the kingdoms of life, and then works symphonically to create an end result, which might be a coral reef or might be a forest.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about sustainable design is that I don't think it has to look in any particular way. One of the things that we really discovered in the last few years is that the new design is actually invisible. The new design is not about a visual boundary. The form, in fact, could be anything. It's the structure and internal logic and intelligence and the performance that has to be designed.
How we make things in our industrial processes it's 180 degree different from how life makes things. Look at the way we make, for instance, Kevlar, which is our toughest material. We take petroleum, we heat it up to about 1400 degrees Fahrenheit, and we bubble it in sulfuric acid, and then we pull it out under enormous pressures. Now imagine an organism, us making our bones or our teeth. Imagine an abalone making a shell. They can't afford to heat it up to really high temperatures or do pressures or chemical baths, so they've found a different way. Now take the spider. This beautiful orb weaver spider is basically taking flies and crickets into the web and transforming them in water, chemistry in water in the abdomen, and out comes this material that's 5 times stronger ounce for ounce than steel. Silently, in water, at room temp. You know, I mean, this is master chemistry. This is the manufacturing of the future, hopefully. And there's actually people who are now trying to mimic the recipes of these organisms.
Paul Stamets, mycologist, author Mycelium Running.
Fungi are the grand molecular disassemblers in nature. They're the interface organisms between life and death. They generate soil. The entire food web of nature is based on these fungal filaments. The mycelial network that infuses all land masses in the world is a supportive membrane upon which life proliferates and further diversifies. Mushrooms also have a very bizarre property of hyperaccumulating heavy metals. Forests are thousands of acres, and so fungi that produce mushrooms grow to thousands of acres in size. This gives us a ready ability to tap into this powerful inherent resource that mushroom mycelium has to remediate environments, prevent downstream pollution from microbes, from viruses, you know, including bacteria, protozoa, and also for breaking down a wide assortment of pollutants. And this is one of the pedestals of mycorestoration, using mushroom mycelium in order to heal environments, because these are truly healing membranes.
That's the model. In nature, there is no waste. One organism's waste is another's food. That's the model for the industrial system that must eventually evolve. A waste-free industrial system.
A forest of dense green treetops.
If we think about a tree as a design, it's something that makes oxygen, sequesters carbon, fixes nitrogen, distills water, provides habitat for hundreds of species, it grows solar energy, makes complex sugars in food, creates microclimates, and self-replicates. So what would it be like to design a building like a tree? What would it be like to design a city like a forest? So what would a building be like if it were photosynthetic? What if it took solar energy and then converted it to productive and delightful use?
For example, if we combine our housing and our waste treatment and our food production and our energy generation, all integrated single whole systems, we can live beautifully on the planet with one-tenth or less the resources that our current civilization uses.
Rebuilding is essentially the design and construction of buildings that are energy and resource efficient. They produce healthy places to live and work. If you take, for example, the fact that buildings account for a third of all energy use, it's really the single largest segment of not only energy use, but greenhouse gas production. What we can do with buildings in just the simplest off-the-shelf technologies is really stunning.
Graphics of the Bank of America building.
So with existing technologies that we basically already have on the shelf or things that we know we can develop in a very rapid period of time, we could literally reduce the human footprint on planet Earth by 90%, right? Which would be a huge shift in what we're doing right now.
The direction to go is to start becoming decoupled from our dependence on oil through efficient transportation, better insulated houses, and the development of renewable alternatives like solar and wind and biomass, and getting those to become the major part of the market using efficiency as the transition. It's not going to happen overnight, but it should have started 30 years ago. And we have right now in the White House and in many members of Congress people trying to delay it further, which to me is ultimately irrational, both for our national security and our environmental protection.
This country can move awfully fast if it wants to. Keep in mind that just after December 7th, 1941, Roosevelt went to Jimmy Burns and said, "You're my deputy president for mobilizing the economy. If anybody crosses you, they cross me. Get to it." Within 6 months, Detroit was completely retooled, not making cars anymore, making military trucks, tanks, fighter aircraft. And in 3 years and 8 months from the beginning of that war, we had mobilized, we had defeated Imperial Japan, Fascist Italy, Nazi Germany, together with the British and our other allies, and begun demobilization. 3 years and 8 months.
These are not technical issues nearly as much as they are leadership issues. How much time do we have? Well, not much. By my reckoning, we ought to be about the business as rapidly as possible. And this means everybody, every citizen, every government level, every organization, every corporation. This is all hands on deck time. So that in the future, 500 years out, let's say that people look back at this time, that this was our finest hour. That humans at that time in that generation, all across the planet, began to come together in a very different vision.
There are on Earth today over 1 million environmental, social justice, and indigenous organizations present. It is the fastest growing movement on Earth. And you're starting to see them pull together and close the loops and plug the leaks of energy and water and food and finance and those things to reimagine what it means to be, as I say, a human being in the 21st century when every living system is in decline, and learning how to reverse that.
It's almost as if we had distributed an ambition without ever having written it down. You know, so that people all over the world knew what they ought to be working on and were working on it in their own way, knowing that they only had one sort of pixel in this incredible mosaic of an image of the future, and that they could contribute that pixel to that mosaic, knowing that in the end that incredibly beautiful image was a sustainable future.
A graphic of Trident Energy. Lester Brown, Earth Policy Institute.
The exciting thing is that we can see now what the new economy would look like. Instead of being powered by fossil fuels, it's powered largely by renewable energy. Instead of having an automobile-centered transportation system, it will have a much more diversified transport system. Instead of a throwaway economy, it will be a reused economy where everything is reused. Indeed, we see glimpses of it beginning to emerge here and there around the world. So we have the technologies to build a new economy that will sustain economic progress. And we can see that new economy beginning to emerge. The challenge for our generation is to build that economy in the time that's available. And I don't think we have a lot of time left.
Virtually all of our major infrastructure changes in this country have been encouraged in one way or another by the federal government. So I would think the way to deal with this transition away from oil is, first of all, not to pretend that energy operates today in an unregulated free enterprise market. It does not. But to go ahead and, as affordably as possible, give incentives to move toward these other fuels and these minimal changes in infrastructure that make them possible.
Energy is the key to everything else that we do. With abundant and affordable and clean energy, we can solve a lot of other problems. Without it, we're not going to be able to solve very many problems at all.
And the sun is the most plentiful, bountiful substitute there is out there. There's more than enough energy coming from the sun every day to run every factory, every home, every automobile on Earth 13,000 times, I think, is the number.
We're also finding that on the larger scale, what we'd call the utility scale, wind energy in particular has evolved to the point where it can compete price-wise with our traditional fossil fuels, that is coal and oil and natural gas, and produce large amounts of energy that can be distributed through the grid, which is the conventional way that we receive energy.
It's important to see, and it's important sort of as we make progress in the world, to have an economy that's flexible and fluid and ready to make changes. How do we protect the atmosphere that belongs to all of us? Well, one of the ways we do it is we make people who are polluting it start paying for that pollution through a polluter pay system on climate change.
So we lower income taxes and raise taxes on gasoline, for example, taxes on burning coal. We could probably do it all with a carbon tax. We're not changing the level of taxes. We're reducing income taxes and offsetting it with an increase in energy taxes, in effect, a tax on fossil fuels.
So when we break our addiction to fossil fuels, you see a lot of money flowing to industries that, in fact, represent the vitality of the American economy. Media, high tech, services. Taking action on climate change is good for jobs and good for the economy.
As an example, if we retrofitted all government buildings built pre-1950, and we created tax environments to help cities and municipalities and states and federal government to retrofit those buildings, we could create 3 million industrial jobs. Plus, we could import much less oil from the Middle East. But more importantly, we'd be having a much cleaner environment.
If we move from the rigged game that we have now in energy to a genuine level playing field, open competition between dirty fuels and clean fuels, I have no doubt that the clean fuels will win. Once we send the right signal from the marketplace, or to the marketplace, that the two guys in the garage who created Hewlett-Packard, well, those two guys today, I want them to be working on clean energy, and I want them to know that we've fixed our public policies so that they're going to get rewarded when they come up with the killer app to defeat big oil. That's what we need to do. Once we do, we'll see a relatively quick transition, I think, to cleaner energy.
That was Vijay Vathiswaran, energy and environment correspondent, The Economist. A crowded city street. A sign reads, Hope. Protesters use their bodies to write, Arctic warning in the snow. Matthew Peterson, Global Green, USA.
People need to realize there are things they can do in their everyday lives, whether it's making simple things like keeping their tire pressure at the right level, putting in compact fluorescent light bulbs. And personal action is important. I mean, this problem of global warming is huge and tremendous, and it may seem inconsequential to take your personal action, but it is important for all sorts of reasons, because everybody making a change adds up to something meaningful, because shifting the way we act and live is part of the solution long term. Because if we act in that way, we will demonstrate to our leaders that we do care. And that's what we need from individuals to, as the next step beyond that, is to build the political will for taking action.
You can also vote. And I don't mean voting at a voting booth. Anybody of any age can vote, because you vote every day that you pay for something. Every time you lay money down on a counter to buy something, you are saying that I approve of this object. I approve of how it was made, the materials that are in it, and what's going to happen to it when I no longer need it and throw it away.
Life creates the conditions that are conducive to life. So our technology, our cities, our schools, what we make, what we wear, what we eat, all of that, if it is oriented around that one principle, that one life principle, then we will be here for a long, long time in an extraordinary world.
Large perforated cardboard boxes are lifted out of a truck and placed in a line on a beach. Watched by a crowd of onlookers, penguins emerge from the boxes and quickly waddle across the sand, hurrying towards the sea, like funny little pint-sized waiters going for a bathe. Ray Anderson, Interface.
The question is, what does it take for humankind to change its ways? And I am really encouraged by Deepak Chopra's statement that people are really doing the best they can given their level of awareness. So to me, winning this battle that we're in to change people's minds and hearts is a matter of lifting levels of awareness, always raising, and it's always a higher level of awareness for any of us.
We need to be slower and we need to be smarter. Slow movement means disengaging from consumerism as the main avenue of experience. It doesn't reject any consumption, but it says we're not going to live our lives mediated by the marketplace or what's being sold. We're not going to make our identities and our meaning based on that. Instead of the long commute, the bigger car, the bigger house, let's enjoy the local produce, have time to ourselves, understand that things are thieves of time. Because the more things you have, the more time you have to spend working, the more your life is chained to a rhythm to get those things. The other element is the smart element. And there I think we have to reintroduce a term, an old term before the Industrial Revolution, frugality. Frugality does not mean poverty. Frugality means the wise use of resources. As I said earlier on, the meaning of the Industrial Revolution was that nature was turned into a resource that was considered endlessly abundant. It's not true.
The sun sets, casting a golden glow along the horizon. Tom Lindsay, Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund.
Not only is it the 11th hour, it's 11:59 and 59 seconds. And although prior people's movements have taken 30 to 40 years to actually build to a point where they had the power and to drive changes into the fundamental structure of governance, we don't have 30 to 40 years.
And so it's not just going to be a matter of, you know, tweaking a policy here and there. It's going to take a very, very broad societal mobilization. It's going to take involvement at all levels, from the government through industry and on down to our communities and a welling up of involvement of citizens.
Winston Churchill had it right about us. He said, the Americans always do the right thing, but unfortunately it's only after they've exhausted all other possibilities. And we've been exhausting some fairly bad possibilities for a long time. I think maybe we're finally ready to get it right.
You know, people often ask me, what can I do? What can I do? I want to do something. Well, the first choice, you've already made the first choice if you're saying that, because the first choice is you know you have to do something. And for the rest, it's a matter of looking deep into your own heart and your soul to understand what your own gifts are, where your passions lie, to do some research and educate yourself, to find the people that you are comfortable with, and then get involved.
There are two things that can perhaps save the world. One would be the mastery of one's kindness to oneself and the big heart. And the other would be understanding your passion for place, for where you live, and really loving the place that you live in.
A couple gaze out upon a wilderness at dusk. DiCaprio stands on a cliff. The blue ocean stretches away behind him.
Environmentalism was once the project of a passionate few. Now, millions of people have responded to ecological destruction and have created the groundwork for a sustainable and just world. With the onset of global warming and other catastrophic events, environmentalism has become today a broader, unifying human issue. We as citizens, leaders, consumers, and voters have the opportunity to help integrate ecology into governmental policy and everyday living standards. During this critical period of human history, healing the damage of industrial civilization is the task of our generation. Our response depends on the conscious evolution of our species, and this response could very well save this unique blue planet for future generations.
Evening falls on a city.
So I see a world in the future in which we understand that all life is related to us, and we treat that life with great humility and respect. I see us as well as social creatures. And when I began to look back and say, what is the fundamental bottom line for us as social creatures, I couldn't believe it because it seemed so hippy-dippy, but it was love. Love is the force that makes us fully human.
Now, to me, the value is the healing power that comes from getting that it's not just global warming. It's not just fossil fuel dependency. It's not just soil erosion. It's not just chemical contamination of our land and water. It's not just the population problem. And it's not just all of those. The deterioration of the environment of our planet is an outward mirror of an inner condition, like inside, like outside. And that's a part of the great work.
So what if we choose to eradicate ourselves from this earth? And whatever means, the earth goes nowhere. And in time, it will regenerate. And all the lakes will be pristine. The rivers, the waters, the mountains, everything will be green again. It'll be peaceful. There may not be people, but the earth will regenerate. And you know why? Because the earth has all the time in the world, and we don't. So I think that's where we're at right now.
That was Orin Lyons, faith keeper and chief of the Wolf Clan. Sunlight beams onto rocky pinnacles emerging from a snow-covered mountain range. Icy white water thunders from its peaks down a colossal waterfall. A cool, pristine river cleaves a path from mountains to lower ground where it is flanked by dense green banks. Water weaves through a narrow gap between mountains to a hidden lake. An unspoilt landscape of wild beauty. White waves crash onto a rocky shoreline. From a pure ocean to a mountain to a blue sky. The sun is hidden behind scurrying grey clouds. The curve of the blue planet, Earth. The 11th hour. 11thhourfilm.com. Join the movement. 11thhouraction.com. ITFC audio description by Aileen Downey. Produced and narrated by Leonardo DiCaprio. Written and directed by Leela Connors-Peterson, Nadia Connors. Produced by Leela Connors-Peterson, Chuck Castleberry, Brian Gerber. Executive producers Adam Lewis, Pierre-André Senerjerges, Irmeline DiCaprio, Doyle Branson, Al De Carolis. Film editors Pietro Scalia, ACE, Luis Salvarez y Alvarez. Associate producer Stephen McGuire. Production design Nadia Connors. Assistant editor Heidi Zimmerman. Original music composed by Jean-Pascal Bianto. Conductor Ken Nagano. Original music composed and performed by Eric Avery. Original 16mm photography by Peter Youngblood Hills. Director of original 35mm photography, Andrew Rowlands. Interviews photography by Brian Knappenberger. Interviews Kenny Asubel, Thom Hartman, Fungare Matai, Sandra Postel, Paul Stamets, David Orr, Stephen Hawking, Orin Lyons, Andy Revkin, Sylvia Earle, Paul Hawken, Janine Benyus, Stuart Pym, Paolo Soleri, David Suzuki, James Hillman, James Parks Morton, Nathan Gardels. Wes Jackson, Joseph Tainter, Richard Heinberg, James Woolsey, Vijay Vathiswaran, Brooke Dolman, Stephen Schneider, Bill McKibben, Peter Domenical, Sheila Watt Cloutier, Ray Anderson, Tim Carmichael, Omar Freela. Wallace J. Nichols, Diane Wilson, Andrew Wheel, Theo Colburn, Jeremy Jackson, Tespora Berman, Gloria Flora, Mikhail Gorbachev, Thomas Lindsay, Michael Glopter, Lester Brown, Herman Daly, Betsy Taylor, Wade Davis, Jerry Mander, Bill McDonough, Bruce Mao, John Todd, Rick Fedrizi, Greg Watson, Leo Gerard, Matthew Peterson, Peter Warshall, Andy Lipkis. Additional interviews: Homer Oridgis, Jerry Franklin, Bill Gallegos, Byron Katie, Uwa tribal leader Burrito Kuwarua, Rabbi Michael Lerner, Steve McCausland, Jeremy Nabi, Carolyn Raffensperger, Iman Faisal, Abdul Ruff, Matthew R. Simmons, Stephen Strong, Nancy Todd, Tez Ozimok, John Trudel, Pierre-André Senner-Kerkes, Deirdre Wallace. Music, Torching Koroviv, written by Stephen O'Malley, James Plodkin, Alan Dubin and Tim Weiskeda, performed by Kanate, number 3 from Zauberberg, written by Wolfgang Voigt, performed by Gass. Charo, written by Arf Henriksen, Jan Bang, Audun Klev, performed by Arf Henriksen. Avalon, written by Jean-Thor Bergesen, August Avor Gunnarsson, George Holm, and Karchen Svensson, performed by Sigur Ros. Chad, written and performed by Toad Liqueur. The White Arcades, written and performed by Harold Budd. Continental, written and performed by Robin Guthrie. Frugal Frelsarin, written by Jean-Thor Bergesen, August Avar Gunnarsson, George Holm, and Karchen Svensson, performed by Sigur Ros. Number 5 from Zauberberg, written by Wolfgang Voigt, performed by Gass. Sigur 3, written by Jean-Thor Bergesen, Ori P. Dyrason, George Holm, and Karchen Svensson, performed by Sigur Ros. Lullaby for Christie, written by Warren Ellis, Mick Turner, and Jim White, performed by Dirty 3. Nibeteri, written by Jean-Thor Bergesen, August Avar Gunnarsson, George Holm and Karchen Svensson, performed by Sigur Ros. White Lake, written by Erik Svotkin and Otto Totland, performed by Deaf Center. Svenji Englar, written by Jean-Thor Bergesen, August Avar Gunnarsson, George Holm and Karchen Svensson, performed by Sigur Ros. Utterly, written and performed by Cocteau Twins. Monliad, written by Jörg Berger, performed by Triola. Soft Mistake, written by Andrew Barlow and Louise Rhodes Rader, performed by Lamb. Wasted Years, written and performed by Ulf Lohmann. Auto Rock, written by Francis Barry Burns, performed by Mogwai. Mogwai Fears Satan, written by Dominic Aitchinson, Stuart Braithwaite and Martin Bullock, performed by Mogwai. Kemp, written and performed by Lucas Haas. Politik, written by Guy Berryman, Will Champion, Chris Martin and John Buckland, performed by Coldplay. Interview shot on location at Bioneers Conference, Marin, California, New York, New York, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, California, Cambridge, United Kingdom, Tucson, Arizona. Very special thanks to www.bioneers.org. Every effort has been made to reduce the environmental impact in the making of this film. This motion picture, copyright 2007, Warner Brothers Entertainment Inc., all rights reserved. All material is protected by copyright laws of the United States and all countries throughout the world, all rights reserved. Country of first publication, United States of America. Warner Brothers is the author of this motion picture for purposes of copyright and other laws. Any unauthorized exhibition, distribution, or copying of this film, or any part thereof, including soundtrack, is an infringement of the relevant copyright and will subject the infringer to severe civil and criminal penalties. The 11th Hour.